Welcome back all to Flammable Penguins. I apologise for the day late podcast. I was running away at Develop last week, which I enjoyed greatly. And so once again, I've grabbed Nick Lewis and Neil Richardson from last week. Nick, Neil.
Hello.
And I just wanted to kind of poke them about some ideas that have been running around my head since going to the conference, because it was really, you know, filled with so many intelligent, bright people. But yeah, the key thing that I think really came through, because I went through to quite a few technical art talks, because they're quite appealing. You know, it's got the art side, it's got the programming side, it's got the design side. It's an interesting challenge. So anyway, one of the talks I found really interesting, which was given by Blitz, was their talk about prototyping and R&D. Mm-hmm. And now one of the key things that, well, it didn't shock me, because me and Tim have spoken about this quite a bit, but interested me greatly, is a large portion of their R&D team is made up of artists and designers. You know, it's a full development team. It's not just a bunch of programmers in a corner. And as such, one of the key things they do is they use Maya as an R&D tool, you know, not touching any code, just literally using Maya and null scripts. So have you ever approached this before? And, you know, how do you feel about it?
I've not used it, but I know that the kind of stuff that you can do, you can, you know, there are mail scripts for AI and things like that in Maya. I think also I can certainly see the reason behind it, because of it's the fewer steps you can have between the concept and the ideas to actually having something playable or usable is so useful. So I think I can certainly see though why they'd want to do that.
To be perfectly honest, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, in terms of, well, in the specific case of graphical effects, the artist will be able to get something visual, really high quality in Maya. That's assuming they're good enough at it. I mean, a technical artist more than likely is. A designer, they'll be able to get something visual, show it to a programmer, and then the programmer will then be able to help them work it into the pipeline.
Yeah, because, I mean, we worked with it on Enclaverment, but they have a wonderful shader graph tool which lets the artists build shaders. And then they've actually put in Maya a whole bunch of things so the artists can, like, see the specular power layer only, or see the, you know, all the different components of that shader and see it in Maya and play around with it in Maya. And as we spoke to last week, you know, shaders are a difficult problem for artists and programmers to balance. So their solution is basically to do it all in Maya, use the shader graph system, and then if it needs optimization later, bring in a coder.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. And also it depends on what you're making, because essentially at the end of the day, you are making an experience. And so the artwork can, although in a lot of cases you can leave the artwork at a basic standard, certainly to expose the gameplay so that people aren't kind of wowed by the artwork. It's certainly being able to do artwork straight off the bat and be able to concentrate on certain parts and show them fully is a really important part of it as well. So yeah, I can see that's a really, really good idea.
Yeah, because like another thing they did is they've been doing a lot of facial customization stuff, because they do like medical simulations and stuff as well. And they wanted to do a makeup mock-up. So literally this big, burly artist guy who apparently is tough as nails sat down for 2 days in Maya basically playing around with techniques of doing makeup and like actually researched makeup books and everything. Apparently he is now the makeup professional in the office.
That's cool.
So, yeah, it's interesting, I found, you know, because R&D, you do typically associate R&D with programmers.
You see, I wouldn't, honestly. I mean, outside of the field of games, R&D is not just technical people. It's all down to people who design. For example, architecture is all part of the research and development process of making a building or building a bridge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the aesthetics of the architecture and how
it's got to fit in to the engineering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
basically,
I mean,
we want it to look like this. It wants to look like X, Y, and Z. Engineers, how do we approach this? How can we achieve this? It's bouncing ideas back and forth, working as a team together.
I think also seeing what you're looking at for most of the game, depending on what the kind of game you have, how much you move around with it. Some games are quite static. You know, we've done a lot of things with board games and things like that. And depending on, you know, what you're doing in the game has a huge bearing on what you're actually concentrating on, and can have a massive bearing on the effects that you're trying to create, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah, seeing that early on is going to be a really important part of it.
Because we had this tripping up with Glow, which is how I got onto the conversation with Tim, was about, you know, doing the level editor 100% in Maya or Blender rather than trying to write our own.
Mm-hmm.
It would be great if it would actually be in the engine, but for that to... well, the engine's a prerequisite there, which we didn't have at the time. We didn't have an iPhone engine written. So you'd done your own level editor and actually made it inside your own engine in parallel to the engine, which I think you've mentioned previously what problems there were with that, so I'm not going into them.
Problems.
But at the same time as you were developing that, we were working on a prototype in which another programmer here had piggybacked off Maya and used Maya for the level editing.
Yes, for
and that made it quite easy. We had a quick turnover of levels being reiterated.
Yeah.
It also lets you, especially if you're doing it all in Maya, for say like the board games and stuff, it lets you play around with whole new... I remember that one experimental piece we had that was very mechanical and, you know, all over the place. Mm. And I think now, you know, thinking back to that project, if we had pushed more into Maya and if we got it to the point... Because, I mean, coding a game of chess or something in Maya is really trivial, because of all the Python and everything. If we got to the point where you could have played, not necessarily a perfect game or have AI in there, but if we could got to a point where the artists could have literally played a game of chess in Maya with their assets.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's the thing is having as few steps, because the biggest problem that we had was the CGFX shaders. Because we weren't able to see the CGFX shaders, depending on what graphics card you had, what version of, what, you know, even down to the OS and things, we had trouble visualizing them. And it just created extra steps, so it took a lot longer to do. It meant that you had to look at stuff actually running on the PS3 to see if things were working correctly. So shortening that distance and saying, well, you know, with a couple of clicks I can see what I'm doing, it also has a massive bearing on morale, because people can see what they're doing instantly. And you can make good decisions based on what you know, the final result. So, yeah, it's shortening that pipeline as much as possible.
Mm. Another interesting point they brought up with the whole shader graph system and pushing more stuff into Maya is they found the artist became a lot more competent in manipulating shaders and a lot more confident with the technical aspects when, for instance, in Maya, they could say, okay, I only want to see the specular map. And he said a lot of artists, before they could play around with it in Maya, didn't actually fully understand that concept. But the moment they could see it and they could play around with it, they fully grasped it and they saw the possibilities of it.
Yeah, I think once you're getting into it at that level, you have to look at it, once you're given the sort of power to do that, then you have to look at it and have to understand it. And I think also the artists will look at like the coders and then see a load of code and how much you're having to do with the CGFX shaders and stuff, and will almost be frightened by the vast amounts of calculations going on. Whereas in fact, if it's made into sort of a node-based system that they understand, suddenly they realise that actually it's much more approachable.
Similar though, when I'd done the Tev stuff with one of the artists, walked him through it and went, okay, just don't write all the code, just copy and paste blocks from here, and I wrote a tutorial for it. But an artist shouldn't really have to go into CGFX. It'd be nice if they could, but they should be able to do it visually the way they used to in Maya.
I think that's where you get the value of technical artists and that level of understanding, because it's such a powerful thing. And I think it's like we touched on last week, it was the mixture of you know, solutions provided by a mixture of art and code. And they're always the most powerful ones and the most useful ones.
Another interesting thing that came up was he went over the whole process that they went through. And the key process was research, proof of concept, iterate, and then educate. Now, research, obvious, proof of concept as soon as possible. I think everyone understands and agrees. Yeah. And then iteration, again, very important. But the thing that made really interested me was the last step, which was educate. They have allocated time and a significant block of time for the R&D team to both document and educate the games teams and the people who are going to be using the tools how to use them.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. There's a lot of things comes down to bug fixing and having a good full understanding of it. I think sometimes in terms of scheduling, I can look at time spent teaching people how to do things, and every minute you spend teaching and implementing that, and also going back and making sure that people are using those methods, is time that you'll get back sort of tenfold, you know, I think, because I know that the coders will stumble across things if art's not been implemented very well, or there's not a full understanding. You can stumble over a lot of stuff, a lot of artwork that hasn't been put in well. Yeah.
We were actually having problems the other day with a bit of art asset because something hadn't been implemented very well, which I'm going to actually have to go in and look at this and finally get it sorted out.
Because the bulk of the education time was actually for the programming team, because people look at the R&D work and they say, oh, that's nice, but they don't really understand it, and the R&D team doesn't want to handhold each new programmer or each new artist through it. And they found if they didn't do the educate step, then programmers especially were just not using the new tools or not using them correctly.
I think
we're going the long way around, doing something the old way.
I mean, there's often redundant code methods lying around, or version 1.1, or...
Don't even get me started on list class version 2.
Yeah. So that was really interesting. That was a fascinating talk. But the other thing that came up both in that talk and in a later talk from the Sony guys who did the iPad program was something that always surprised me, because Neil's always talked about using morph targets for facial rigs, and that's how we do a lot of it here. But driven a lot by expressive faces and moldable faces, and also sort of the Pixar quality coming back into games, facial bone rigging seems to be like the popular thing now.
I was thinking about this quite recently, and yes, you can certainly see why, because it's not, you know, there's various different reasons, and I have to go off the way I would do it, but blend shapes aren't necessarily going to give you what you need in terms of producing the mouth shapes and the phonies that you need, because you need to be able to bend and rotate things. You can't, with the blend shapes, it's that problem of having verts that will go from straight from one target to the next without being able to go around. So that particularly is something is going to cause a problem if you've got cheeks deforming over bones and things like that. Lips that need to fold over, teeth. And there's a huge amount. And also being able to manipulate the bones and get target expressions quickly, because you may want to get really nuanced expressions, and having a bone system is going to be a much easier and quicker way of doing that than shoving verts around, because you'll be able to have one set of bones that you're moving around, get your target set up, whereas if you want to get a very nuanced expression, something that's unique, somebody's pulling a really crazy face, you don't want to have to build an entirely new blend shape necessarily just for that, and then just use it on one frame. So I can certainly see why they would do that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for the iPad facial rig, obviously the iPad's an exception because it's the only asset in the game, essentially, other than, like, tertiary assets. But I think they had, like, a 40-bone rig for the face, which was, you know, really over the top, but they did. And I think for the animation system was broken into state machines, and the facial animation system had something like, oh, it was a ridiculous number. I think it was somewhere close to 100. It was really up there, you know.
Yeah.
I can't remember it off the top of my head, of possible facial expressions.
Yeah, okay, you would need... The amount of information read from a face, obviously, is massive. And I think the more that you pile into that and the more that you put into it, the better that gets. And I can certainly see why they would do that. It's something that, you know, games are going to have to do because of this sort of dead-facedness of even quite, you know, recent... characters where there's a lot of time and a lot of effort being put into things, but you not being able to achieve the effects that you want with blend shapes, I can certainly see why you need so many expressions, such a complicated rig.
But there is a reason that we do traditionally use morph targets.
Well, see, the reason that I tend to stand by morph targets is they're actually pretty damn optimal. Provided the face hasn't got a massive amount of vertices in, which you don't generally need to. Depends on the platform and the game. iPad needs as detailed as possible. It's the only asset that can go over the top. But for one of our previous titles, I think there was PDC World Championship Darts, the first one, it didn't even have facial animation, really. It had the face was rigged, but it was bones, and it didn't actually move much. It was then the second version which were pushed out, which had morph target animation on their face, where we actually gave them some form of expression. It actually looked a hell of a lot better. It actually looked like they were alive instead of just this face.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also, going back to what's fit for purpose as well, in terms of being optimal, and also it literally comes down to how many, you know, the proportion of the screen that you're seeing the person's face.
Yeah.
And how much do you, you know, it comes down to scheduling as well. Where you're looking at, you know, is there a script? How much are you going to see them? How much they have to express and all this? And choosing the right option depends very much on that. So, yeah, I think certainly in darts it worked very well because the face was such a smaller proportion of the screen, so you could get a lot from that. So it worked very well.
Yeah, I mean, because, as you say, fit to purpose, no, morph targets aren't going anywhere, but if you've got a character-driven game, which we haven't done we at least haven't done a human-driven character game. I mean, darts and now Petanque, both are games which have people in it, but their expressions and their personas not the key point.
No. And I think that's it does come down to proportions also in terms of the number of characters. You know, you've got the pet, which is going to be the thing that you're looking at.
Yeah.
So obviously the focus is going to be such a large part of it.
Mm. But very, very interesting because, as I say, previously I had sort of dismissed facial bone rigging as, you know, something that we just don't do, but it does seem to be coming more into trend.
I think it's certainly the focus on, you know, seeing films and having to keep up with that. And when you've got that motion capture data as well and you're having to pull meshes around, you know, you're really trying to push vert over bones and copy muscle systems and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you need something like that really in your armoury, I think, for that.
Yeah, especially for non-human characters, like characters that have human traits but are not necessarily human, like cute animals or anthropomorphic characters,
mm-hmm.
The expressions tend to be a bit more over the top.
Yeah, and you're commuting, you know, when you're communicating by expression as well, mm-hmm. And also the age group and looking at who you're actually trying to communicate to. You need to, a lot's going to come through on the expression, and I think some of the blend shape systems, you know, wouldn't necessarily be up to that.
Yeah, I mean, they do use blend shapes with the facial rigging because, like, puffing cheeks and mm-hmm. a few other things are there. But now, there was a lot of interesting technical tricks that came up with. Like, one of the things on the programming side is traditional rigging, when you translate a bone, doesn't necessarily transform the normals.
Yeah.
So they came up with the trick of doing the transformations on the spew, so it could be optimized there. I mean, obviously that's a PS3 specific solution, but
you're saying when transforming the bones, transforming the normals in
doing translation on a bone in a normal rigging system doesn't alter the normals. Rotation and rotation alters the normals, but actual just translation doesn't.
So you're basically imagining. No one will be able to see what I'm actually doing with my hands here, but you can see you've got two normals vertically pointing the same direction, whereas if the bones stretch, they won't start bending off towards the
joints. A lot of it was with
the
facial bone rig, because in the facial bone rig, you're translating a lot, and like on the eyelids and things like that, you do want the normals to change, but there's no like rotation necessarily happening.
So they need to recalculate, like basically regenerate the normals instead of actually transforming them.
Yeah, so it's done on the spew as a specific job to just do a normal pass.
I mean, it's cheap enough to do, but if you want to do a really good job of it, you've got to take into account every affecting, well, triangle for that vertex.
Yeah, which was why it was.
And then there's all, when artists start tweaking their shading groups. That's right. Is that right, Nick?
What, in terms of the fiddling around with the normals and things? Or
I'm thinking shading groups, so I'm thinking too much of terminology somewhere hidden in our engine. You know what I'm.
Right.
I think I know what you mean. For example, if you set smooth shading on a cube.
Mm.
You would actually want a group per face?
I guess so. It depends how you do it, and it depends what system you're using.
Right.
It's kind of tricky with it. Yeah, you've got, you know, XSI, you've got your clusters. It depends on how you're breaking them up, really, it's all a bit. Everybody uses everybody else's terminology. It's kind of tricky.
Now, the other interesting thing that came out, especially from the iPad talk, was there's the mathematically or the realistically right way to do it, which, to be honest, we never actually do. We always do some form of compromise.
Smoke and mirrors.
And one of the interesting things with the iPad was they had a whole bunch of specific little problems, and they couldn't solve them in a general way. So what they did is they sort of looked at each individual area, and they tried to solve it for that problem. So, like, one of the problems they had was the ambient occlusion algorithm. The normal one just wasn't working for the iPad. So then they looked at the key problem areas, being the tongue, the teeth, and the eyes. And then they did a solution where they were doing a render target, where they were rendering the geometry of just those and those, and doing a very specific hacked solution for the problem areas. So how often do you find it's best to approach things from what are our problems, and how often is it best to approach things from what's the general solution?
I'm more inclined to try and always look for a general solution, but sometimes if you really can go a little bit over the top and you need to put a bit of extra detail in somewhere specific, or if you need to optimise in some way, you need to have a look and do something really horrible and dirty. I think World Sports Party, we imposted a few times, but that was only in specific cases because it was so close.
Do you want to explain that a bit more?
Basically, on a four-player split-screen game, we couldn't get the performance up with the characters rendering. So what we done was we just rendered them all off to a texture.
Yes.
It's a trick that's been used for years on many titles.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about that as well is these kind of tricks, I think, depend on where you are in your, you know, in the development. You know, you get towards the end and you're informed by things like your frame rate.
Yeah.
And also in terms of priority, because those are the things that people look at, you know, teeth and eyes and stuff like that, where you get, you know, the inside of the mouth is just too bright and things like that. A lot of that comes down to evaluation, probably towards the end. And because when you're putting in kind of tweaks like that at the beginning, because the development, it's a little bit like fiddling with the genes of a child, and then you're like, okay, we've turned its eyes blue, and then when they get to 23, they've got another arm. You know, it's one of those things where you want to just leave that kind of thing to when you really need it towards the end.
Yeah, because they were doing some of this quite early.
Right. I think, yeah, maybe it just depends a lot on you know, your experience of your own system as well. You know, maybe this is something you want to attain, and that's been targeted and said right at the beginning, you know, we need this to be as high quality as possible. And I know that it's the kind of thing that you would see in you know, in films and stuff like that, and animations, they'd want to target that kind of thing too, to stop the sort of really bright mouth kind of effects and stuff that you might get. I think on the whole, those kind of targeted tweaks I'd rather do towards the end. I've seen too many times where you just get re-bitten seriously by trying to do a hack early on, and then somebody trips over it later on in the cycle.
Okay.
Now that stops being a hack if you invest R&D time.
Yeah.
Because then the R&D team would actually come up with, well, we've got this solution, because if we do it this way, it might cause us problems at this point in the game. It might cost us too much performance. It might not work with our fur rendering technique. However, if we do this, we've tested it and tried it, doesn't bite us anywhere, we can have twice the quality of this effect in this specific case. That's when it becomes not a hack, because it's been researched thoroughly.
Yeah, it's that thorough researching. And it comes back to education and saying to people, this is an established method, and these are the pitfalls, and this is what you've got to watch out for. Hacks that are done by two people, like an artist and a coder on the side, not telling anybody else, is guaranteed to get somebody tripped over later on.
Yeah, document and educate. Yeah. Because a programmer who's no longer with us, Alice, she was really good at bringing in specific effects to address problems, like in Petanque, we never had dust on the balls, and then she put like dust on the collisions and stuff, and all of a sudden the collisions felt a lot more real.
Mm-hmm.
And in World Sports Party with Dodgeball, loads of little targeted effects which really just brought out the depth.
It's that extra towards the end as well, the extra effort that goes in makes a huge difference to the overall quality. And it's that, I think, the 20-80 ratio of 20% extra effort, and you get so much more from it.
Okay. Well, I mean, as we've mentioned, that, you know, Pixar is already, you know, those sort of high-quality films are already influencing us in the gaming industry. Now we're looking at systems like Move and Connect, and we're looking at trying to match player motion to in-game motion. What ideas do you have at maintaining the quality of the game characters and the game characters' almost elegance against the stuttering motion sometimes of the player.
Now, since this is new to us, since we're working with it right now, and I've just finished implementing inverse kinematics, and Nick's just had to rig an IK, like actually set up an IK rig for me to use in-game, which is yet to be tied to the move by you.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem because, as I say, games are almost hyper-real, and we want to maintain this, you know, sort of flow. But at the same time, the input data we're getting is not necessarily great.
Yeah, I think, yes, I think it's that massive problem, the extra amount of variables that can go into it, you know, the what-ifs. And you can see that in a lot of games. I mean, not necessarily move ones, but even where the animation's trying to tie together and with the code and making adjustments in jumps and catches and things like that, where it's not necessarily working particularly well. It's such a new area. It's such a difficult thing to necessarily say how we would approach it. And it comes down to, I guess, just experiencing that at the moment.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
We first had a go at it when we first started working on the Wii, when we had to tie animation to how the Wiimote was moving. And it was just a case of, it doesn't have to be perfect. We'll get it roughly. The player's going to be holding the Wiimote like this. When they move their hand, it's going to go to these range of angles. The animation copes with that. A little bit of geometry and just work it out from there.
Yeah. I think also it's a tricky thing of trying to tie a specific animation to an action on, say, the Wiimote, where you drew the wheel. If you were going to throw the ball in ball or patong, you draw the Wiimote back, you're playing one end of the animation, then putting it forward and playing the other end, which is nice in theory, and you do throw it and it can work okay, but it's the what-ifs, and if people do things differently, then it becomes a bit of a problem. So that comes down to probably a huge amount of time that you would certainly schedule into the project and say, you know, what we know is about 10%, what we're going to find out is, you know, is the other 90%. Yeah. So you've got to add the extra time onto it.
Okay. Well, I mean, the other talks I went to that were very interesting, there was a few focusing on drama and storytelling in games, one particular good one from the Fable 3 team. And now this is something that we on Glow had a lot of discussions about, and we had to cut back a lot because of resources. But it's also something you've dealt with before in other games. And how do you feel about storytelling and narrative in terms of the game world? What are your initial thoughts?
I think, initially when we tried making Futurama and trying to do storytelling in that, that was supposed to all be in the engine. There was never the intention of producing 30 minutes of straight animation all rendered out. So it was, the storytelling was meant to ideally happen all in the game. And I still think that would be a solution that you'd want to aim for. So it was more the technical considerations that we ran up against.
Okay, well, I'm getting a wrap it up signal from Patrick there. But so we're unfortunately going to have to cut the dramatic storytelling off. I want to do it. I'll most probably do it later in the week, guys, and release it later. But there is loads to talk about in this area. It's really interesting. And it's something we've thought a lot about, as I say, with Glow. We did push it a lot. Okay, well, thanks again to Neil and Nick.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And always give us feedback on the blog posts, on Twitter, or just randomly think thoughts, and the hyperwaves will pick them up. Thank you, and see you next week.